This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. How are you doing today?
Good.
Very well. How are you?
Doing fantastic. You guys, it's great to have you back on, Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle, as always. We love having you on as well. We are talking today.
Oh, thank you.
We are talking today about...
It's already started.
I know, right? Am I going to have to play another thumper clip next podcast? We'll see.
Oh, man, we're already in trouble. I think so. This is already bad.
All right, let's go.
All right, well, what's up? Today's topic, we've got a few questions from our listeners, but we're going to start the show with the topic of imposter syndrome. Now, this is an article that is coming out. It's coming out actually in December of this year, volume 115 of the Journal of Vocational Behavior. And the name of the article, the name of the study is "I Must Have Slipped Through the Cracks Somehow: An Examination of Coping with Perceived Imposterism and the Role of Social Support." Now, this was done with a collaboration of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Nevada, Brigham Young University in Utah, and Stanford University. And so it's a 57-page study, so we're not going to go through all of it, but a few choice quotes that I've got from this article. It's actually very interesting because we've been doing this podcast long enough where now I'm looking at this and piecing this together. And I'm Dr. Lyle, I'm hearing your voice in pretty much all of these explanations. So just a little bit from this study. Perceptions of fraudulence by high-achieving individuals has been labeled by previous research as, quote, the imposter phenomenon or the imposter syndrome. But most existing research characterizes the imposter phenomenon as principally dispositional and is focused on uncovering other individual traits and negative outcomes that are correlated with these perceptions. But this study seeks to relax the assumption that perceived imposterism is dispositional and assumes that these perceptions are malleable and suggests essentially dynamic. It suggests that this imposter syndrome may actually be triggered by various contextual characteristics and then can be mitigated by certain effective coping tactics. What they also say is that previous research on social support and imposter syndrome treats social support as a one-dimensional concept and suggests that more social support will mitigate this imposter syndrome. But these authors are arguing that the source of social support may be an important consideration when seeking to understand the relationship between social support and imposter syndrome. So this was done in two different studies. Yeah, so it's a long-winded way of saying what you've been saying on this show, Dr. Lyle. So first they introduced the idea of imposter syndrome. This was first introduced on clinical observations of accomplished women who felt that their success was undeserved and then were concerned about eventually being revealed as a fraud. However, more research found that perceptions of imposter syndrome are not isolated to high-achieving women and can occur as individuals develop across the course of their careers and encounter situations where they may perceive that they are, quote, out of their league, like training for or starting a new job, entering an elite group, or receiving some sort of promotion. So there were two studies in this, and they're very long-winded, but essentially the first study, they were identifying who gets imposter syndrome, and they interviewed 20 different students. And they were trying to identify all the little variables that have to do with imposter syndrome. So they actually had the interviews in the study, which was some quotes from the interview. And the authors said that most of the students that were interviewed were extremely successful in high school. and their first few years of college, which helped create a concept founded on being a high-achieving student. But after these students were admitted to the undergraduate accounting program, they started to compete against an increasingly impressive peer group. So many started to feel that sense of imposter syndrome because they then encountered a larger group of students who were able to perform at their same level, making it difficult to view themselves as one of the best students in their class. So in contrast, the dispositional view of imposter syndrome, people indicated that feelings of imposter syndrome were confined to the particular program rather than feeling like they're fraud in other areas of life, which was interesting because one of the interviewees, direct quote, says she suggests that feeling behind others is a natural feeling that occurs when a group of capable, hardworking individuals are competing against one another. So we go on their way of coping with this was to escape by doing certain activities like playing sports, having a part-time job, taking some breaks, video games, religious worship. They found that students could find balance, but if they spent way too much time, like for example, one of the interviewees spent about 5 or 6 hours a day playing video games, that actually did not help with the imposter syndrome. It left him very unhappy and even more feelings of imposter syndrome.
Let me get this straight. You got to tell me, this is 57 pages we're wasting on this.
Oh, yeah.
And three groups of social scientists at BYU, Nevada, Las Vegas, and Stanford.
Yeah.
So they scrape the bottom of the gene pool at those three places.
We've got to question that self-concept.
What's that, Jen?
We've got to really question the self-concept that these young people have of themselves and what's so challenging to it in this new environment. It's really mysterious. It's just really it's going to take a real crack team of experts to unravel
this. I've been feeling the imposter syndrome ever since I met Dr. Hawk. Yeah. I used to have a concept of myself as a smart person.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's been slipping for 3 years now. Yeah, this is incredibly absurd, and I can't believe that this is like blind people like in a cage with elephants that they've already seen them before, and they just can't imagine what they're feeling. It's just amazing. I don't know. Have you got a better way to describe what we're listening to, Jen? Jen, why don't you just roll out on this thing and explain it to everybody?
Yeah, I mean, it's we've got this on this podcast. I feel like people are they're already at a level where they're familiar with the nature of competition and the fact that, you know, when we're intimidated by a competitive problem, we get obviously very accurate messaging from the nervous system about our standing in the hierarchy, and that's what's going on here. But it's also so much of this is personality. So much of what we think of as imposter syndrome is personality interacting with context. Because disagreeable narcissists are not really subject to what we would think of as imposter syndrome. It's not really in there. It could possibly, if the environment is just, if they've gotten themselves in just over their heads enough, but they're just less likely to experience it than someone who's agreeable and conscientious. That's what it is. So agreeable, conscientious people.
Alan Goldhammer.
Yeah, right.
Alan Goldhammer didn't feel like he was an imposter when he was 9 years old telling all the adults.
No. Yeah, exactly. That's the kind of psychology that just doesn't exist in there. It doesn't matter how out of his league he is. He makes his own league. He defines the rules as he goes. He's 0% agreeable, as we know. We've made him take the test. So, but someone, I've spent a lot of my life in various imposter syndrome processes because I'm very agreeable and I'm very conscientious. So I never feel like I quite believe. Long. I always feel like someone made a mistake. These phrases that you hear people say, and then you put me in it's dependent. It's context dependent on my position of power relative to the situation. So when I was in high school, like these study subjects are, you're very clearly getting the signals that you're doing better than most people. Everything's cool, no problem. Nobody's coming up on your heels. There's no reason for anxiety. You go off to college, and suddenly it's a different deal. You've got every everybody. Now you're in a peer group where you're just one among many who share equal skills, and you've been coasting along for a long time, not doing the fundamentals, not building the self-esteem process. And of course, that's going to unleash all kinds of anxiety processes and what we would refer to as an imposter syndrome. And of course, people are going to respond to that by resorting to various faces of the ego trap. They're going to go play a bunch of video games. They're going to go try to avoid the problem, or they're going to try to reframe the problem in other ways that we see people reframing competitive problems. So there's no huge mystery here as far as why people would be feeling anxiety about being taken down a notch in a competitive hierarchy.
It's utterly ludicrous that anybody would spend 5 minutes studying on this. And they're acting like there's a debate between dispositional and situational. Like, well, you know, others have thought that this was dispositional, but we have a different view, you know, more optimistic view that that this is situational. Come on, everybody. How to get published? Yeah, every single personality characteristic personality is dispositional and not changeable.
Yes, personality.
Yeah, the experience that the person is having at any given moment.
Dispositional just means innate for people who don't know.
Yes, personality is innate, and the experience that you have at any given moment. If you're Al Capone, you know that with a gun to your head, suddenly you get very agreeable. Okay, and suddenly you get
even
submissive.
Even Alan might.
Yeah, even Alan.
He might.
I don't know.
He'd still find a way to make it seem like it was his idea.
Yeah. So this is absurd. I mean, this is like calling it something the hot syndrome. Like, I don't know. Every time I go into a sauna, I feel hot. You know, what is it about that? That's what this is. So this is an amazing display of ignorance. And yet, mm-hmm. like, when was this published?
It says December. It says December 2019. I'm assuming that's not a typo. So it's coming out soon. But
no, it's not. So it's coming out. Oh, good. The world gets to hear a bunch of drivel from some people that are publishing on personality that have not studied the field. Wow. How cool is that? But hey, you know, welcome to academia. It's a pub. If it's a pub, it's on the scoreboard.
Yeah, it is. That's all that matters. Doesn't matter if you're the 47th author listed in the fourth institution and it's a useless study. It's still a pub.
It's a pub.
Still goes on the CV.
It's part
of the tenure race. Yeah. Oh, man. But this whole thing, I mean, people often, we can move on if you want to, but there's one.
No, go right ahead, Jen.
Continue yammering on this unless we have more pressing things. But people will often kind of confuse the imposter syndrome with the ego trap. They think they're the same thing, and they're not quite, but they are, I mean, to the degree that the chronic imposter syndrome is a personality problem. It's like if you're just never feeling like you're good enough and you're never supposed to be there, they shouldn't have let you into the club, you slip through the cracks, that's your personality, that's your distortion cross to bear that you have. But there is, much like the ego trap, the more, this is why we harp on the self-esteem process so much and the process of addressing the fundamentals of a competitive problem. If there is any resolution to imposter syndrome that's context dependent, it's by really throwing yourself diligently into the fundamentals of the problem, just like you would get out of the ego trap. So convincing your nervous system as best as you're able that you haven't left anything on the table, you've done the best you can, you're just as trained up as anybody else, you deserve to be there just as much as anyone, you're doing the same work. And this is like any other process of distortion. The more experience you have, the more feedback you get, the more you're able to calibrate these estimates over time.
Yeah. And what they did is as typical social scientists, they said, well, what you really need is social support. Okay. And so our big brilliant insight is going to be who you get the social support from. Okay. This is all like really patty cake. And I mean, is there some truth in it? Yeah, there's a little bit of truth in it. But what Jen's talking about is massively more important insight. And of course, you know, it's not these fault that these people don't have it. They don't have it figured out. But it is their fault. Yeah, it is their fault that they are blatantly ignorant of personality, clearly. and they act as if this is a I don't know, some either personality or fascinating, you know, dynamic, rather than just simply high conscientious people that occasionally get in situations behind their achievements that put them in water where they're no longer obviously dominant. No problem. Like, I wouldn't call that a syndrome. I would just simply call that a continuous variable on a psychological experience, just like how hot it feels in the sauna. That's just what it is. And, all right, Nathan, let's move on.
Is this a way...
Now that Dr. Lyle's thoroughly disgusted.
So I guess this is also a way to figure out, to find your ceiling. So would you say that if you're not maybe not regularly finding a ceiling or not bumping up against the ceiling, that means you may not be taking enough risks or working hard enough? Would you say that?
Or that you're just a narcissist.
Yeah, well, I mean,
you could be, or you could just be really, really disagreeable and really just super, super confident. And so it's going to be personality and context that are running the show here.
No, what I mean is if someone is feeling totally secure in their position in life and studying or jobs, does that mean that they may not be working hard enough, essentially, that they need to have a few losses, that they need to have a few situations where they are feeling like, uh-oh, I'm a little bit above and I need to work harder to get where I need to be?
This is a typical natural process for people. And what the nervous system is attempting to do, remind me where I'm going with this in case I get lost, everybody, but what the nervous system is doing is it's attempting to send you, it computes what would be the highest rate of return of gene survival on any action that you could take. That is the purpose of nervous systems. The purpose of nervous systems is to regulate movement. And so what this machine is attempting to do is to contract muscles in a sequence and in a combination of muscles and their sequence of movements in order to optimize gene survival. So that's fundamentally what a nervous system does. It doesn't matter where we find that nervous system, if it's in a cat or if it's in a giraffe or a human, it's always the same. That what the mind is a computational device to bring in data from the nervous, you know, from the sensory system and consult both memory systems and resident algorithms to try to figure out what muscular contraction pattern would optimize gene survival. And so what the system is doing is it's running a rate of return on capital. It's running a rate of return on investment is what this is. Now, I totally forget where I was going with this.
Ceilings, well, hitting ceilings.
Oh, hitting ceilings, right.
Not setting your bar high enough.
So, yeah. So the issue is that the nervous system has a signaling device to tell you when you are not optimizing rate of return on capital. It's called boredom. Okay, so that's what it is. It's a feeling that says, this is too easy. And if it's too easy, I know that life is inherently competitive. And for a human, the competitive process is going to involve esteem. So we're trying to be more in a position to earn more esteem from mates, friends, and trading partners. And so if we're bored, we're in a situation where the system knows that the rate of return on its investment in terms of the energy that it's expending is likely to be suboptimal. That it's aware that there are competitive domains that it could be improving its standing. And it knows this intuitively. It can smell it. That's what its job is, to simply figure these things out. So of course it can tell when it's too easy. Okay, so that's why nobody, you know, trying to learn how to high jump basically gets over the 2-foot bar and then just keeps going over the 2-foot bar for the next year. Now, within minutes, they're like, well, let's put it up to 2.22. Let's put it up to 2.4, 2.6. Okay, the excitement is when you're designed by nature to attempt to reach the limits of your capacities in order to compete as effectively as possible for the finest trades that you have in the esteem marketplace. So of course, You don't get to just sit around and do the same thing over and over again easily without a price. Now, it isn't that people don't do this, but when they do it, the price is boredom. And that's the impetus. Excitement is the signal that you are reaching possibly the ideal situation in terms of your time and energy investment in an opportunity. Okay. So this is where it's like, hey, this is as good as it gets. This is now determining our entire, you know, focus now, because there's an opportunity to mine either an increase in our abilities or an increase in our esteem trading process. And so this is falling in love. This is, you know, seeing a great old friend that you haven't seen in a while, or this is, you know, a new business opportunity that you haven't seen before, and now it hasn't been available before, and now you're super excited about it. Or it's just, for example, doing work that you're really good at, but it's at the limit of your abilities. So you are pushing hard that day to try to use the best of your ability to solve a difficult problem. And your nervous system rewards you with the excitement as it says, you are working as hard and demonstrating everything that you're capable of, and it's watching you, and the excitement generated is the system essentially analyzing the rate of return on time and energy capital, on whether or not we're optimizing gene survival capabilities. So that's actually how that works.
Fascinating. So would you say that if someone is trying to achieve something and they're working hard at something and they're not feeling some versions of this imposter syndrome, that they are likely to feel that if they're on the right path towards achieving their potential?
I want you to back up and give us that question again, because I want to make sure I understand it.
Yeah. So if someone's working at a problem, would it be normal for anybody working hard at something that's maybe a little bit out of their league at first to feel these imposter syndrome type of symptoms or characteristics?
No, it wouldn't.
Anxiety. Yes. Imposter syndrome.
That's correct. Imposter syndrome would have the additional inference that other people are thinking that you're at a level of ability that you are not confirmed that you're at. Okay. But Jen has it exactly right. What would be normal would have anxiety about whether or not you could accomplish it, feeling of uncertainty and challenge, but not the imposter syndrome. Imposter syndrome is specifically associated with the ego trap looking dynamic, where you believe that people are overestimating your abilities, and therefore, you know, you're getting this feedback from the nervous system that there's additional status risk because you may not be able to live up to expectations. So that's what
Thank
that is. Imposter syndrome is a cousin. What they're calling imposter syndrome, you know, is just a psychic experience that is associated with your estimate that the village is overestimating you.
In your your innate estimate, you're systematically undervaluing yourself because you have a personality that does that.
You could, or you could just be someone, right. You could be someone that is experiencing that because of unusual environmental circumstances. But most likely what we're seeing as I read this thing, it said 20% of people or whatever. It's like 20% of high achieving people. Well, that makes sense. In other words, 20% of high achieving people are on the top 20 percentile of the conscientiousness curve. So what do you suspect that all those people, if I give them a big five test, they all land in the upper 20% of the conscientiousness curve? Mystery solved. Okay. Yeah, that's it.
But all the king's men can't do that in this particular study. They can't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. They're not going to administer the big five.
I couldn't give him a 35 question test.
No, it's too hard to do.
Fascinating.
All right, Nathan. Let's go.
All right.
Ahead
well,
and move
speaking
on.
Of finding ceilings, here we have a question of a young man who have found a ceiling near his house. So, dear Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk, lots and lots of ugly background here, but I'll try not to wander. My wife and I have been separated for 2 years, ink to paper on an ugly and contentious divorce in May. I have primary custody of our two kids. Daughter is 17, son is 14. And I live in the home which we've owned for 20 years. A couple of weeks ago, I came home to find my son and two of his friends up on the roof of our little sun deck. I asked him what he was doing and if he was being safe, and they said they were playing army. So since I've coached the other two kids in mountain biking for almost a few for almost a decade, I knew their parents wouldn't mind them being up on the roof. So I told him to at least put the ladder away when he was done and to keep his phone on in case I needed him to come down. I was actually more irritated because he didn't put the ladder away. So they did this every day for a week until a few days ago when my daughter came home from her job. And in her ever so sweet and acerbic tone, asked me if I was really so stupid to think that my son and his friends were playing army. And she let me know that the real reason that they're up on this roof is that our 22-year-old neighbor was in her backyard topless, and the son had set up a perch on the sun deck to get a better view. I climbed up thinking that she was just trying to get him in trouble, but sure enough, the deck had the perfect view of the Chase lounge chair where I assumed the girl had usually sat. I told my son to knock it off, and he said he would. Well, last week I got an angry knock at the door, and it was my ex-wife and the neighbor, who they've been friends for many years. And apparently the neighbor called my wife sometime last week, and they had agreed that they would confront me and my son in the morning. We sat down, and it went from a calm, this is something we're concerned about, to accusations of me being an irresponsible absentee parent, and that my son may potentially lead to an adolescent sex ring in a matter of seconds. I tried to remain calm and explain that they are just acting like 14-year-old boys, and I've gotten them to stop. My wife asked if I planned on punishing him, and I said that I don't feel like he did anything punishment worthy, and rather that this was a learning experience about respecting people's privacy. Well, my neighbor said that if it was her son, he'd be in intensive psychotherapy and medicated. I told her that was really overkill, but my wife told me not to talk to her friend like that and asked them to leave before it got any more nuts. My wife since texted me that I'm being incredibly irresponsible, and if I don't do something, she's going to go to her lawyer to revisit the custody agreement. In all of that, she called me an asshole several times and said it was more miserable being divorced from me than it was to be married to me. Well, there goes my weekend. I guess that's about it. But I have to ask, am I the asshole for how I'm handling the situation with my son?
I'll lob this softball to Dr. Hawk.
Softball.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, my God. I mean... No, he is like spoiler alert. He is the reasonable one here. He probably knows that, which is why he's submitting this question, getting a little status from, you know, to painting this picture of this disagreeable character of the ex-wife and the friend. So, I mean, I love this question because this is great because this is what relationships are, whether it's your ex-spouse or whether it's a friend or whether it's someone you're currently married to. Like, relationships are stable equilibriums between stable personalities. And sometimes those personalities are super disagreeable and ridiculous. And that's probably why he's not married to her anymore. And she's absolutely overreacting to this. He's handled it completely reasonably. They're 14-year-old kids, you know, and he told them to stop and he corrected their behavior. They're opportunistic 14-year-old, presumably heterosexual or heterosexual adjacent boys. Like, this is not shocking. There's nothing shocking about this. They took it too far. He told them to cut it out and they did. So turning this into some broad debate about their psychopathology and trying to medicate them, this is appalling. So, and also the neighbor, I feel like the neighbor is likely jumping on board this collective hysteria to overcompensate for what was probably a little bit of a Mrs. Robinson situation. she probably knew they were watching and she's like just signaling her, you know, outrage in solidarity with the ex-wife here. So This is what happens when you partner with someone disagreeable who's going to overreact in situations like this, and then you have children with them, and then you're bound up in the dynamics of that relationship even when you end the relationship, and you still have to manage these disagreements over how to discipline or not discipline the children. So this is totally ridiculous. He's totally in the right. His ex-wife is completely overreacting and the neighbor's a nut.
It's beautiful. It's great. The my comments would be I had a friend of mine named Ana Real, lives down in San Jose area, and 20 years ago we had many conversations about life, and Ana had a saying, "Don't breed with freaks."
I knew that was going to come out. I thought that was Larry's saying for some reason, but I almost said second ago. Yeah, be careful who you mate with, people.
Don't breed with freaks.
Yeah. Seriously.
So first of all, what's really interesting to me is the sanctimonious, you know, neighbor. I'm surprised she has a daughter that is topless in the backyard. It's like, the apple fell kind of far from that tree. So that's kind of curious.
Oh, maybe I misunderstood the question. I thought the sanctimonious neighbor was the one bathing.
No, that's
topless.
The mother. Right.
Oh, it's the daughter. So, the apple did not fall from that tree.
I think it did. Yeah. In other words, some kid that's back there with her top off is not too sanctimonious at all. She's got a free spirit. So her mother is some...
Yeah. But that's why I think we've got some overcompensating moral outrage.
Yeah, well,
here.
The mother's, you know, exactly wouldn't be interesting to the 14-year-olds, but the 22-year-old is. So the, and the 14-year-old deserves, if it was my kid, I'd give him a plaque, give him the James Bond Award.
The emerging porn king. Give him a little Hugh Hefner jacket.
That's what it would be. Yeah. So yeah, he's gonna go far. Those genes are headed to a good place. There you go. All right. Let's go on.
But it's like these arguments. It's also just worth reminding people that these conflicts over discipline and, you know, if you don't get the discipline just right, or the kid's growing up in too permissive of a household or too controlling of a household, and that's going to affect who that child becomes. This is completely wrong. Like, it has no bearing upon who that child becomes. The child becomes exactly who the child is going to be, regardless of what kind of childhood discipline context it's raised in. So when you're dealing with, if you have bred with a freak and you're dealing with this kind of disciplinary conflict, then it's the pick your battles. You know, would you rather be right or happy? Like, getting into it with somebody disagreeable about how to discipline your kid actually has no impact on who that kid turns out to be in the long run. All it does is make you miserable.
How would you suggest that this man deals with this situation? Just stand firm and...
Yeah, that's actually...
Yeah, just stand
actually,
firm.
Actually, there's such a wide variety of options to this. One of them would be like, go ahead, you know, have fun with your lawyer. Like, no problem. Okay. It's like, knock yourself out.
Sure.
Okay.
This is not a custody risk.
That's no custody risk. Only the most worthless lawyer would take her money for anything like that. So, that'd be one thing. That'd be one reaction. The other reaction is, I hear what you're saying. Makes sense. You know, I have to really, just complete shining the person on, but not quite letting them know that you're doing it. You know, that's doing absolutely nothing, and I would put the James Bond plaque on the wall.
All right. Well, our next question is about a little more sneaky James Bond guy. So maybe the James Bond villain over here. So, dear Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, one of my boyfriend's colleagues was leaving work recently, and she had a staff party organized because of that. So the party was supposed to take place in the restaurant in which they are working. However, they ended up in a strip club afterwards. My boyfriend claims that he did not get a lap dance or anything else, but his married coworkers were paying girls for dances. And I don't really believe the innocence of my boyfriend anyway, but never mind that. I have questions about my feelings regarding the situation. It does bother me, and I'm wondering if that is caused by my insecurities and my own body dysmorphia. I wonder if a woman who is confident about her looks would be fine with a situation like that. Are my insecurities at fault here? Because no matter who I date, I may end up in a similar situation. Or are my negative feelings reasonable and I should look for another partner because this one demonstrated that he is willing to create opportunities for defection? I'm just trying to understand my low mood in this case. Should I stay because I am the problem and what he is doing is normal and commonplace? Or should I leave because situation is caused by his personality type? And are there guys that do not end up in strip clubs in these cases? I'm 25 years old and our relationship has many other flaws, which made me doubt it even before this particular situation.
Well, just have at it, Jen. I'll be interested to hear what you have to say.
No, I get this one too.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that really jumps out with this one is how she's just signaling right and left how she's already unhappy in the relationship. She tells us like three times, you know, she doesn't trust him, but that's not relevant. We'll come back to that. And then she's, oh, the relationship has other problems. And so the strip club incident is a little bit of a pretext for this relationship's in trouble anyway. I guess as far as the strip club being a deal breaker, why she's feeling the way that she's feeling, this is going to be this is personality mingling with context. So some women are going to feel insecure in that situation, kind of regardless of who they're dating and what degree they're over rewarded or not. But almost every woman at some point, if she is sufficiently over rewarded and she's, you know, in a position of weakness relative to her competitive value vis-a-vis this guy, she's going to be more prone to those fits of jealousy because the likelihood of losing him is higher. So her perception of the likelihood of losing him is higher. So if it's the opposite, if you're someone who is kind of predisposed to fits of jealousy about this kind of thing anyway, if you're super under rewarded and the guy worships the ground you walk on, your threshold for where you're going to experience that jealousy is going to be lower. So it's personality plus context. But it's like, to me, that the essence of this question is, it sounds like he doesn't qualify. He just doesn't qualify. She's already made up her mind about that to some degree. And the jealousy over the strip club is a bit of a red herring. And yeah, not your soulmate, lady. You're 25, you know, take a risk on another adventure.
Yeah. I would say, one tiny thing that you just said, I would, mm-hmm. it would be the notion of who's qualifying and who's not qualifying.
It's very possible. Yeah.
It's very possible.
So this is
she
a preemptive
qualify.
Strike.
And that, yes. And so the, yeah. And there's, and the thing that Jen's also describing here, she's describing a lot in that answer, but one of them is this was a perfect like little slider of explaining the context and personality. But the personality issue here is, I mean, independent of the particulars of this question, which are absolutely signaling a conflicted relationship that's, you know, in trouble. Would be the notion of, let's suppose that the relationship was actually quite good and very solid most of the time, but this was a point of conflict. This is where we have a process of self-discovery of the individual, where you discover that it turns out it makes you very uncomfortable to be in that situation, and it's not a good one for you. People differ tremendously in their inherent openness around sexual issues, and so I've known people that their attitude towards their husbands or boyfriends going to strip bars is like, oh, I'll go with you, or hey, whatever, have a good time. Like, they're not actually threatened by this. And it isn't because they don't care, and it isn't that they don't feel that they don't have a good deal and that they're in an inherently competitive situation for that partner, but they have a natural openness to essentially feeling like, you know what, there's no big threat coming from that quarter. They're not running off with a stripper. And they're not sleeping with a stripper. And also, if I respect the fact that males have a casual mating strategy circuit in that head that could probably use some form of expression and experience from time to time, then maybe that makes me a more valuable pair bond partner. Okay.
Continuum of chippy tolerance.
What's that? Yeah, chippy tolerance. Yeah.
It's a continuum of chippy tolerance. Yeah. Yeah. Whether it's sort of like behavior, sort of suggestive and performative around it, like a strip club, or having an actual chippy on the side. Like, yeah, women are absolutely going to differ profoundly on that dimension.
And so part of your young life is the self-discovery process through relationships, which are sometimes the only way to find out, you know, what is the nature of your nervous system? What is, in fact, your identity? And so you find out, you know, you can, if somebody asks you if you like salmon, the only way to tell them is to have it tasted at once. And if someone says, well, how would you be if your boyfriend went to a strip club? You know, you have to kind of have something like that happen in order for you to discover, you know, how is it that that makes me feel and how threatened am I and how upset I am? I know people that are very... inherently very closed and extremely sexually conservative, and anything like that is just so far out of bounds that it would just disqualify that relationship. And I have other people that would just sort of roll their eyes and laugh. So it's
Tuesday
night. Yeah, it's a, what's that?
It's just Tuesday night. It's just Tuesday. That's just what we do. Yeah.
So this is a individual difference process, as well as the dynamics that Jen was talking about.
Okay, so our next question about openness now is, does personal wealth increase openness? I'm 30 years old and I feel as though I've become wealthier and I've become more open to new experience. Due to some HCNC behavior, I've increased my personal net worth from effectively zero to about $250,000 in the past 5 years. While this may not seem like much to some, I've done this on a salary no greater than $75,000. Therefore, relative to my lifestyle expectations, I feel very financially stable. Sorry for the humble brag, but it feels as though this has been the primary factor in my feeling as though I've become much more open to experience relative to my mid-20s. I'm not saying I've jumped from the 10th percentile to 90th, but maybe 40th to 60th. Does this seem likely to you?
Yeah, go right ahead, Jen.
Well, this seems like a very, I mean, we can definitely let you spin out the full logic of this if you want to, but I kind of feel like when we're on the podcast at the same time, I don't know if anyone out there ever watched the old McLaughlin group on PBS, but I feel like John McLaughlin with these curt little answers like, no, wrong, issue one, like moving on. So at this one, like, of course you're going to move on this dimension on openness or anything else. There seems to be a theme tonight of personality plus context.
Yes.
Like personality plus environment. So it's this is how, when people say the environment matters, this is how the environment matters. So this person's position of power has changed. They can afford to risk more. They literally have more money in the bank. They can make more mistakes. They're financially secure enough to go make some really exciting and fun and glorious mistakes. I'm jealous as an open person myself. So it's absolutely reasonable that your situation, and especially your relative position of power in a situation, is going to affect your relative risk tolerance. And that is going to cascade down the spreadsheet of your cost-benefit analysis on everything that you're doing in your life. One of the ways that that's going to make itself apparent to you and manifest in your life is how open you feel to having new adventures that you were not open to having before you were in that position. How willing you are, if you're an agreeable person, if you've been in a position of weakness at your job, you're going to be very meek and you're going to take on every little assignment that your boss gives you and you're not going to make a peep about it. But if you feel more and more secure in that job because you know you have very specialized skills that no one else can do, or you've gone out and you've applied for some other jobs and you know that you could find another job no problem, you're going to feel yourself becoming a little more aggressive, a little more disagreeable. It's not that your personality has changed. It's just you're more willing to set some boundaries and stand up for yourself and create your experience in a way that you were not when you were in less of a position of power. So there are all kinds of ways that these things can change for people over the course of their lifetime, depending on what's changed in their life and what's going on. And money is a huge, huge dimension of this question. So completely reasonable. I guess that was a longer answer than
I just love it when she
answer
talks
is yes.
like that. This is just fabulous. Yeah. Now I'll come in with the sort of little laser analysis, and that's that. If you think about this, you understand that the differences of as just as Jen is describing, obviously, that your circumstances change with financial capability, and therefore the risks actually. The risk tolerance actually is not changing if we look at this technically accurately. So the personality is remaining exactly the same. But what was a risk that would cost you, for example, 3 gene units of risk, is now cannot the same outcome, the same bad outcome of the boss frowning cannot cost you 3 units of gene risk when you've got $250,000 in the bank. That frown can now only cost you 0.3 units of gene risk. Okay? So the very same worst case scenario no longer carries the same risk. And so as a result of that, it will inexorably lead you to be more assertive about expanding your range of potential opportunities. It will force your algorithms to cause behavior that you will not have seen before. Okay? That's just how it is. It can't. So looked at through the proper perspective, what I would call a Plumian perspective, where we're looking at the personality algorithm as genetically fixed. What's happening is that the person's environment is changing. Okay, so the person is standing in the same place relative to other people in terms of the construction of their neural circuits. On a bell curve, and their relative risk tolerance, their relative introversion, extroversion, everything else under the sun, okay? Let's imagine a person, for example, that had some disfigurement on their face. Maybe they had a very unattractive nose, something like that, and they were otherwise like quite attractive, but the nose made them was grotesque enough that it actually caused them to fall from a 9 to a 6, okay, because it was pretty funny looking. And then one day they had saved up their quarters and they get a nose job. And now suddenly they go from a 9 to a, they're a 9. They go 6 to a 9. Okay. And so now what happens is that they're very likely to be, quote, more outgoing. And the reason is they're picking up cues from the environment that attractive other people are encouraging interactions with them. So their algorithm is still, they're still just as shy or just as outgoing as they ever were. But this, the context around them, their environmental circumstances have shifted considerably. Okay? And so this is actually the right way to think of it. The personality does not change. However, the person's manifest pattern of behavior can change substantially because their circumstances have changed, not because they have changed.
Dr. Ladd, would you say that intelligence is affected if someone's not making a lot of income?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, Jen, fire away on that. Yeah, you used to be merely very smart. Oh, go ahead.
I mean, there's not making income, and then there's financial insecurity. So financial insecurity can definitely affect the expression of your IQ, because you're too bound up with trying to solve too many other problems and living month to month and paying your bills and you're too distributed. But as far as like having a general low income past a certain threshold where your basics are met and you're not worried about how you're going to feed yourself and your hypothetical dogs the next month. I think there are diminishing effects after a certain point. But certainly, yeah, financial insecurity. I forget the exact percentage of IQ it knocks off. Is it like 10 points?
It was a lot. I think it was on the order of 10 to 15 points, which was huge.
Yeah, it was a very significant amount. So this is documented. If you're in a situation where you can't pay your bills and you're struggling, you are basically paying the price with your working IQ, which is a really hefty price to be paying if you're trying to solve big problems in the world.
Yeah. Very good. Great question.
Yeah, where would be able to read more about that study? That sounds fascinating.
God knows. You're going to have to just look it up.
Yeah, I don't know the original source.
It's out there in the world.
Yeah. We can find it and put it on the Facebook page, or I can post it somewhere. Yeah.
I don't think it's that hard to find.
And I don't think it's just one study. When I first heard about it, I went hunting for more evidence to see if it was just like something that someone had documented with 10 grad students or something. But no, it's actually a well-documented effect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Last question.
All right. Very good. Last question. There are many, this is a pretty long one, so I'm going to read the question, then we might end up answering it next week. So there are many prophecies of Homo sapiens more and more visibly splitting into two socioeconomic lines. I'm thinking more along the lines of some people happening to be more fit for the modern environment, having financial sense, capable of long-term planning, not living on social grants, and being able to navigate the various pleasure traps in the modern world and not acting like animals trapped in the zoo, and the people who fail at these, like, of course, tend to mate with. So do you see these gaps widening or closing?
Interesting. That's a pretty big question. There's some inferences there. Jen, go ahead, and you've thought about these types of things probably for a long time. So just go. Let's hear what you have to think about it.
Yeah, to some degree. I mean, this is a fallacy ignoring a couple of different things. This idea that that because like mates with like, because you're sticking to people who look like you, have a similar intelligence level, similar social norms, all of that, that you're going to basically create these mini siloed civilizations within a common shared environment. And this is ignoring a couple of things, like the fact that none of these characteristics are being driven by single genes. So people still have sort of single gene thinking about some of these things, as if there's a single gene for intelligence or there's a single gene for conscientiousness. And they're not. These are clusters. These are very complex, like tens of thousands of genes interacting. And so, and all of this is working very hard to always return to the mean of the bell curve in any given population. So you can have two geniuses mate with each other and produce a pretty, smart kid, but not a genius kid, because the pull of the average of the mean of the distribution is always returning to the mean. So as long as you're sharing the same general environment, general selection pressures, you're not going to have entirely different civilizations inhabiting the same sort of space in the way that people like to scaremonger about this. There's a lot of derivative conclusions from that, but that's the main thing that I would say about that question.
Yeah, there isn't two distributions. There's one big monstrous bell curve is the best way to describe any population. And so you're not going to, so that that's a, so the person saying prophecies, I don't know who's being prophetic about it, but whoever's being prophetic about it, apparently didn't understand that, which is kind of basic and important. Second of all,
reminds me a little bit of some of the Charles Murray stuff, and the it's reminiscent of some of the Charles Murray inferences.
Yes.
That you're going to have the haves and the have-nots, essentially, the two Americas, that we're becoming increasingly polarized because some people are more intelligent and able to work in the ideas economy rather than the labor economy, and that this is contributing to this polarization process. That's what this rings up.
Yes, right. And intelligent and interesting discussion in 1986. Now we know a great deal more about behavior genetics and population genetics, and so we're going to change our mind about things. So, for example, it's going to turn out that, as Jen was describing, if two non-related people, two non-related people randomly drawn from the population, the difference in their IQs is 17 points. That's just in general. Just go out in the world and point to two people in line at Disneyland, and the odds are any pair that you point to, typically if you do it to 100 times and run the averages, it's going to be 17 points different. If you look at a parent and child, the average distance of a parent and a child's IQ is 13 points. It's about the same.
Isn't that amazing?
Okay. So, right. So there's no way that you can get a interbreeding elite and that, but it was not unreasonable based on some inferences that a Murray might have been thinking, and people like that might have been thinking all the way back to the dawn of eugenics. They wouldn't have known what Jen is describing, this very powerful regression to the mean, and how essentially the genes are churning their way in ways that are not conducive to this kind of a bizarre situation. That's how it works.
All right, it's a little over my head, but I guess we'll ask you more about it next week.
We should just have a whole podcast devoted to the bell curve, just to really
the McLaughlin answer is wrong.
You should
too. Not going to happen. All right. Yes.
All right, very good. Well, thank you both for coming on again, and I will look forward to speaking with you in future episodes.
Pleasure, Nat.
Pleasure. Thank you, Nathan.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.